Hi everyone, my name is Eugenia Chow and I run the Instagram account Ugreenia. The Everyday Activist podcast is founded under the belief that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to activism and anyone can get involved. Holly Rose is a writer, Kiss the Ground Soil advocate, and intersectional environmentalist who aims to amplify education on regenerative equity through storytelling. Her writing is crafted with the intention of marrying traditional ecological knowledge with sacred ecology and regenerative sustainability in ways that encourage reciprocity in the relationships people have with all living things. Based in the UK, she also works for the Green Party, which aims to create a just, equitable, and sustainable society. In this episode, we discuss regenerative sustainability, Indigenous knowledge, how to navigate the nuance of eating sustainably, what it means to build community resilience, and moving forward with the Green New Deal. One of the first guests that I had in mind before starting this podcast was actually Holly Rose, and so I'm super excited to finally have her on the show today. I've learned so much from reading her writing on her blog and from following her Instagram account, and she is actually the one who inspired me to take the Kiss the Ground Soil Advocacy course, which taught me all about regenerative agriculture as a hopeful solution to climate change. I learned so much from having this conversation with Holly Rose. She has so much wisdom to share, and I hope that you also find this interview just as valuable. Hi, Holly, and welcome to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. It's really exciting to have you here. Firstly, could you please introduce yourself? How do you describe the work that you do, and what's your environmental narrative?
So my name is Holly Rose, and I was born on Treaty 1 territory in the country we now call Canada. And I migrated back to the United Kingdom when I was in my late teens, I guess, and I basically lived here or in other places in Europe ever since. And I was sort of brought up in a way that my mom tried to raise my sisters and I to sort of honor the earth and its four seasons, and then to also respect human and non-human beings and to sort of raise our voice for their rights. And I would say probably around the time I moved to England, I wasn't really invested that much in being a good human. I was, you know, wearing fast fashion and eating whatever packaged foods came my way and wasn't thinking about my impacts on the planet, but I had been brought up, you know, in a very sort of sustainable environment. And it wasn't until, I mean, the early 2000s, I sort of entered back into the sustainable environment or the eco-conscious environment through sustainable fashion. I had been working in the fashion industry in London, and I realized the issues with the production system and also how impactful it was on the planet. And that was sort of before, you know, fashion revolution and stuff like that happened. I remember being like in a basement of some cafe with like Ursula de Castro, one of the women who started fashion revolution, with like nine other people, listening to her talk about ethical fashion and what that system might look like. And it's come such a long way since then. And in 2016, I started a blog and I wrote 365 blog posts about how to live more sustainably, looking at every product I had and habit I had. And that was my main focus, was really like finding better lifestyle products for my life so that I could live a more eco-conscious lifestyle. And once I'd done that and looked at 365 different aspects of sustainable living, I realized that sustainability wasn't enough, and so I went looking for other solutions, and via rewilding, I ended up coming to regeneration, and that's mainly what I talk about now, which is creating systems that enable environments that all beings can thrive in, whether they're human or not human beings. And that's basically what I write about now, is the long answer to a short question.
Yeah, I think it's really unique how, or I guess like different from mainstream sustainability writers or environmental content creators, because you focus a lot more on regenerative sustainability and not just sustainability.
Yeah.
So for anyone who's unfamiliar with this term, could you explain a bit more about the differences between these terms and why you prefer to focus on regenerative sustainability rather than just sustainability?
Yeah, so I mean, sustainability is essentially allows like racial capitalism, what's causing all these issues with our environment and with human rights issues. It allows that hierarchy of racial capitalism to proliferate, because it essentially just creates the way we, or it adjusts the way we consume so that we replace the products that we consume without changing the way that we consume. So we replace the products with products that do less harm, and systems that do less harm, but not systems that do less than no harm. And the really interesting thing about regeneration is it's giving back more than you take and creating environments that allow for human and non-human beings to thrive. So it's more about creating systems that all beings can thrive in, rather than creating systems that business can thrive in, or that like consumerism or capitalism can thrive in. So I think at the beginning of my journey, I would maybe have called myself a conscious capitalist, in the sense that I was just looking for edits to the current system. I didn't realize how destructive the system was. And I was only beginning to understand the ethical issues, the social justice issues, the human rights issues. I knew that there was problems in our production system, but I thought they were problems that existed away from where I lived. I didn't realize how the systemic issues of the systems of supremacy that we dwell within really impact every aspect of our reality, especially those folks who are, you know, non-binary or Black, Indigenous, or people of color, who are marginalized by this system. And the system we have now is degenerative. So it's the opposite of regenerative. It takes and it gives nothing back. It creates environments that nobody can thrive in, except for a super small percentage. And even then, I would argue that like, billionaires are probably not the happiest people in the world. So essentially nobody thrives. Some people get rich, but yeah, that's kind of the difference is, you know, one example that a woman I know gave was like, if you were in a relationship and you responded, oh, my relationship's sustainable, to like how your relationship, to describe how your relationship is, that wouldn't, you know, indicate a very happy relationship. But if you said my relationship is regenerative, it helps me thrive, that would indicate that you're creating environments that both you as individuals can thrive in. And that's essentially what we want. We don't want to sustain degeneration. We want to sustain regeneration. We want to create environments that everyone can thrive in. And that's why I've kind of gone down the realm of regenerative sustainability to sustain regeneration.
Mm-hmm. So I guess when I think about regeneration, it's still within the context of agriculture, just because that's how I learned it.
Yeah.
But how do you say that this form of living, of living in harmony and also living in a way that gives back more than you take, applies to different areas of life? And what does living regeneratively mean to you on the whole?
I think for me as well, my intro to regeneration came through like regenerating land, through agriculture, through rewilding or reforestation, any of those sort of agroecological pieces of Indigenous ecological knowledge that are finally being given the respect and amplification that they deserve. And I should say that like the majority of my knowledge comes from books written by Indigenous writers, as well as from Kiss the Ground, which is, I think, a course you did as well, the soil advocacy course. And I think I did the course about 2 years ago, after reading Wilding by Isabella Tree and being just enchanted by the fact that through regenerating the soil, they were able to like increase the turtle dove population in their area by 400%, and like monarch butterflies returned to England and things like that. And this just, you know, this one aristocratic estate, and how hopeful that was. I had so much of, you know, who I was and what I was doing was based around being angry and judgmental of other people, which is, you know, super exhausting. So when I started to learn about regeneration, one of the things that I found most inspiring, especially once I was able to remove myself from my, you know, studio apartment in Paris and move back to England and find a house with a garden in Hastings on the southern coast of England, as I learned about the land and was able to start working with the land and growing plants and like, you know, having my first garden and stuff like that, really seeing how there's so many, you know, lessons to be learned through caring for other beings, whether it be plant beings or animal beings or human beings. There's so many lessons that you learn about yourself as you're trying to help another, you know, being thrive. And through the principles of regenerative agriculture as well, there's a lot to be learned there about how, you know, diversity is key and how we need to be rooted, or sorry, plants need to be rooted in the soil in order to regenerate soil, and their roots need to be kept in the ground. But similarly, we need to be rooted in our communities and be grounded in ourselves in order to be able to be healthy and thriving. And we also need to be creating environments that other beings can remain rooted and be grounded in themselves, whether they're human or no. Things like, having a diversity of plants instead of a monoculture like that, you know, as I started to work in politics, I've just been sort of delving into it for the past 11 months. But as I started working into politics and noticed that there's a monoculture of middle-aged white men, cis able-bodied middle-aged white men, that create all the rules and policies and laws for our society, and how that's not really representative of the society that I grew up in or the society that I live in, and how we need to not have a monoculture in politics or even online in this, you know, so-called sustainable community. For the majority of my time in that space, there were very few Black, Indigenous, or people of color able to contribute to that conversation and have access to, you know, the privilege of time that it takes to become successful in that realm, or even, you know, access to photographers and things like that to, you know, create those very well posed and edited photos that give people attention in this day and age. So, you know, you can kind of go down all the six rules of regenerative agriculture and be able to find some lessons, you know, for your own life. And then as I started working harder on my anti-racism work, as I started to work in politics, as I started to sort of exit out of selling products and into really trying to look at the way our system is structured and how to dismantle it from the inside out, I realize that a lot of these principles apply to every aspect of our reality.
Mm-hmm. So I always forget that not everyone knows what regenerative agriculture is, and I only really started learning about it when I encountered your page on Instagram, and I of course was inspired to take the soil advocacy course through Kiss the Ground. So could you actually briefly explain what regenerative agriculture entails and how this differs from conventional agriculture and how it benefits the environment as well?
Yeah, for sure. And it always makes me so happy when, like, I feel like I've actually accomplished something with my life when I hear that people have actually done the course. So thank you for letting me know that, because that, yeah, that's the goal, is like, not, it's not about me talking about this stuff. It's about everyone being empowered to become advocates for soil wherever they live, and everyone contributing to this, you know, regeneration of our society and everything. But just to kind of put it simply, regenerative agriculture draws down carbon. So the reason that we have global warming is there's an overpopulation of carbon in the atmosphere, and there's the same number of carbon atoms that, you know, on the planet now that there have been since the beginning of the time. The problem is they're just stored in the wrong place. So when, through tilling the land, so through the type of agriculture that we do, where we use agrochemicals, we till the land, we grow monocultures of plants, we overgraze, we, you know, do all these horrible things to the land through the way that we produce food. We, you know, open mine for fossil fuels and minerals, breaking up the soil, and move all that carbon that's being safely stored in the soil where it creates life and does good, and, you know, almost displacing it into the atmosphere where its overpopulation causes harm and takes life. So, you know, the cause of global warming is solar radiation essentially being absorbed by those carbon atoms, which then sort of create a blanket around our planet that heats it up. And if the carbon is drawn back into the soil, then that reverses global heating, which prevents climate breakdown. So it's a real big solution, and the holding capacity of soil is incredible. And it's not just the carbon, it's also like water capacity. So as we saw with the recent fires, or that are still raging in California, and that will probably begin to rage in about a month's time in Australia again. One of the reasons that these fires are so out of control is because the land is completely desertified. So there's not enough moisture in the soil, there's not enough moisture in the plants in order to prevent the fires from, basically we've just created, the land is basically kindling for those fires. And I just actually recently, I don't know if you were at the Soil Advocates monthly webinar this month, but there was a woman there, Linda something, who was talking about how she's really, really delved into the cause of the fires and how to prevent them and how to save people's homes when the fires happen, which are going to continue to happen every year. And a lot of it has to do with all these principles of regenerative agriculture, where you don't till the land because that breaks up the soil aggregates. And soil aggregates are essentially like the coral reef for all the life that lives beneath the soil. So there's more life and achievement of soil than there are humans on this planet. And the diversity and health of that soil life is what makes healthy soil. And it's also what makes healthy humans and a healthy biosphere. That's an indication that carbon's being drawn down instead of released. And so it has all these sort of like, it's almost like the center of a web, the soil. Like it has all these sort of threads that come off of it that impact different aspects of our reality, whether it's our food, whether it's our health, whether it's our air, our water, the fires. And when the soil is healthy, it's able to retain water. So that makes it less, you know, likely to burn. And it also means that in times of flood, like we've seen here in England, that water is able to be absorbed by the soil. Whereas if it's dried out, it becomes like concrete, so the water can't infiltrate and it runs off into our waterways, which makes that kind of brown river water that we often see. And it also means that in times of drought, so when there's no rain, that the soil is able to stay alive because the plants and the soil and the soil life are, or the ability of the soil to hold water is enhanced. So it's able to hold huge amounts of water and withstand, you know, a month without any rain. The other aspect is having roots in the ground. So obviously, if you think of, you know, soil as that coral reef, without the roots in the ground, it doesn't have the coral in the coral reef. So there's nowhere for that soil life to live. And the soil has nothing to hold on to. So there's kind of this like gluey stuff that roots emit, and that holds the soil together. It's called glomalin. And when we till the land and don't have roots in the ground, it takes that out. And also without roots in the ground, the plants can't photosynthesize. So that means that carbon's not being drawn down. That means that soil life's not being fed. Diversity is key. So when we have a mono, just like we need a, you know, bunch of different types of plants in our bodies to be healthy, the soil needs a bunch of different types of plants in its body to be healthy. And so when we grow monocrop, it's only getting one type of nutrient to feed that microorganism, or one type of, the one type of plant is photosynthesizing. So anyways, that's, you know, that's kind of the essentials of it. On top of that, there's holistic plant grazing. So when animals are mimicking the ways that they developed alongside the landscapes that they're native to, they are kept on the move like they would have been, you know, with predators, or would have been, you know, back in the day when we were hunting them and not farming them. And so when we holistically plant graze them, they basically defoliate the plant, kind of like a tree does in winter, where it just drops its leaves. And so there's all this organic matter, all this plant matter on top of the soil. And then they one up the tree by like pooping and peeing and stomping on that soil. And that feeds the soil life and also protects the soil life, because keeping the soil covered is another one of the rules. Like always having plant life in the soil and keeping it covered with plant life means that that soil is protected. It's essentially got like an armor over it. And it's constantly drawing down carbon and contributing, you know, to clean air, because photosynthesis creates our oxygen as well. So yeah, you can basically like follow all these different threads onto how healthy soil creates healthy people, healthy planet, healthy biosphere, healthy relationships, however you want to look at it. It's a really interesting thing to kind of delve into and explore.
Yeah, I love how you were able to summarize that without getting it bogged down by like scientific, like very scientific facts. Because I know that can deter people.
And for me too, like I'm not a scientifically minded person. I'm really not. I mean, even I'm training to become one of the spokespeople for Kiss the Ground, but it's also not like scientific facts aren't necessarily what inspire people to be interested in this stuff. Like for me, it's all that enchanting stuff, like that there's more life in a teaspoon of soil than there are humans on Earth, or that the scent of soil stimulates oxytocin, which is the love hormone that is released when mother and child are bonding. But yet we get that same, you know, love hormone stimulated when we sniff some soil.
Yeah.
And I find that stuff so enchanting, more than like the water, the exact number of, like, I think it's like 150 million hectares of land can hold like a certain amount of water, but it's, you know, that's not what is sexy to me personally.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
for sure.
I try not.
And it's all about appealing to what is interesting to other people, and that's how you get them to care about these causes.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, so I feel like a lot of people, they hear about this and they think, okay, I'm not a farmer. How am I supposed to contribute to these regenerative practices? How am I supposed to apply these soil techniques in order to draw down carbon? So what advice would you give to someone, an individual who isn't involved with farming? How could they incorporate these practices or incorporate this knowledge into their everyday lives?
Yeah, I mean, there's a cut, you know, I would say like support regenerative farmers. And here in England, I've slowly been compiling a list on my blog of like UK regenerative farmers. You can get, you know, maybe not perfectly regeneratively grown food, but mostly regeneratively grown food from Riverford, from Farm Drop, we have a local farm here in East Sussex called Peapod, which is like, you know, just on the hill behind my house. And they're creating, you know, all these food boxes. There's all these local farmers and gardeners, even in London. Jack's Patch is, you know, doing food boxes in Hackney with Hackney grown regenerative food. And all of these farmers really need our support. You know, like they're the subsidies and policies that our central government creates for the land are not made to help smallholder farmers, who are generally the people who are regenerating the soil and creating healthy food and healthy ingredients. So you can also, you know, there's Fiber Shed in the UK for fashion, which is, you know, natural fibers coming from regenerative farms and that are grown alongside regenerative food. So there's all these really great ways that you can support regenerative farmers if you just know where they are and what their products are being made into. But of course, because the subsidies go to the farmers who are farming in ways that are degenerative, that kill the soil, you know, unhealthy, non-nutritious, you know, food that's grown with agrochemicals and grown in monocultures is cheaper than food that's grown with high nutrition value and grown in ways that regenerate the soil. So not everyone has that option. But if you do, that's a great way to contribute to it. Another way is growing your own garden if you have access to land. And if you don't have access to land, like, there's so many, you know, corners in the town that I live in where I'm like, oh, we could put, you know, just one box of like lettuce, where anyone could go and grab some lettuce from this one, you know, little vegetable box. There's a movement called Edible London, or I think it is. I know for sure Edible Lambeth, but I think there's an incredible edible or something like that. Throughout the UK, or if you look up transition towns, there'll be some sort of garden you can contribute to, or that you can have space in if you're not able to have that space in your own home. On top of that, just like any plant, like taking care of any plant is technically pulling down carbon and regenerating soil, even if it's just in that little, you know, in that little pot. And obviously if you have a lawn or something like that, looking at ways to plant wildflowers instead of, you know, pouring chemicals on your lawn or keeping the grass short, because that doesn't help draw down carbon. Another great way is composting. Some of us have municipal composts. Most of us, I think, in the UK probably don't, but, either creating a community compost with somebody who has a back garden or front garden for that matter, or, you know, lobbying your local town hall to create a municipal compost system. That's a huge way to contribute to regenerative agriculture, to help farmers out, to reduce waste. I'm trying to think if there's any other ways. Take the soil advocacy course. Like, there's so many. The knowledge is really, really power. Like, I can't kind of stress that enough. And I know that a lot of people don't have the privilege of time to be able to just, you know, be able to even take free courses, because the ground offers scholarships for folks, especially non-white folks. And just having that knowledge, even though it's a little bit overwhelming and it's very intense and it's scientifically based, they want you to really understand the science, but they also want you to understand the enchantment and empower you with whatever information you need to then use the gifts and skills that you have. And everybody has something to give. We're all like so unique, but we're all so gifted. Like everyone's built to contribute to society in some way, shape, or form. So I think just taking the course or reading Braiding Sweetgrass was a great place to get started.
I'm currently reading that. It's so good.
And it really, she's an Indigenous woman and she's also a botanist. So she's really got the understanding of science, but she's really involved in her culture as well. So she has the Indigenous knowledge, and that marriage between the two, I think, is really the key to our survival. And part of that is uplifting amplifying the voices and knowledge of Indigenous people without sort of whitewashing it. But, you know, because we live here in England, our Indigenous people are ourselves, essentially. So we need to get back to the practices that our ancestors used to regenerate land before, you know, we got colonized and started colonizing other people and doing all the horrible things that we've done.
Yeah. So you mentioned a bit about supporting local farmers and regenerative farmers. I remember reading a post that you wrote on your blog before about how being vegan isn't enough for the environment, or it's not like the only solution for the environment, and how it's a lot more nuanced when it comes to eating sustainably or in a way that reduces your environmental impact. I was just wondering how you sort of navigate this, because I know I'm personally always very conflicted about whether what I'm eating is like the best thing I could be doing in terms of the environment. And it's also like you have to balance the ethical aspect of not wanting to eat meat and also how like farmers are being treated. So I was just wondering how you navigate that.
I mean, so I know there's a lot of, and I don't disagree, obviously, that we need to eat less meat. That's obvious. We can't, you know, have as many degenerative animal farms that we do, but there are, you know, through rewilding, meat is produced because we don't have any natural predators. And so folks who do want to eat meat, I recommend, you know, buying it from Neff Castle or some of the rewilding projects, or some of the projects like, the Fibre Shed in the UK. We have, you know, a female shepherd, or through the Land Workers Alliance, there are, you know, Welsh shepherds, folks who are producing or who are creating meat products as a byproduct of producing regenerative vegetables or regenerative fibers for the fashion industry or for, you know, the furniture industry, whatever. You know, there's ways to eat meat that are ethical if that's what your body needs. But I think it's this whole thing of like approaching something as a binary, as this is good and this is bad. Like, the true food sovereignty and true freedom is having the right to make the choices that are right to you. And when it comes to food sovereignty, it's the right to culturally appropriate food. And that isn't something that we can homogenize, what's appropriate for certain cultures and what's appropriate for our bodies. So I definitely don't agree that veganism is the only way. The vegan movement has been hugely greenwashed and ethical washed. I specifically don't trust the vegan symbol by the Vegan Society. I went to one of their conferences, I guess it was like almost 2 years ago, hoping that they'd be talking about some of the ways that you can regeneratively farm, plant matter in order to support a vegan diet in ways that regenerate the soil. And instead of having that, they were producing a lot, they were promoting a lot of, imported packaged foods that are created through the use of ghost acres, which are essentially like colonized land. Like we import something like 80% of our food, including vegan products. And when we eat in that way, we're causing harm to other people and other people's soils and essentially like stealing nutrients from them. And it's not to say that you shouldn't eat any imported food or that you shouldn't eat a vegan diet. I think you should have the choice to eat however you want, and that we should have laws and policies that allow everyone to make that choice and not have to do all this research to figure out what the most ethical way is. The most ethical way should just be the way that it is. But for now, the easiest way to sort of know, if you will, like that you're eating the right thing, I think, is to order from Farm Drop, from Riverford, or from a local producer and try to eat as locally as possible so that you can actually speak to the farmers. Even if they're not regeneratively farming, you're at least supporting your local community, which has more kickback than sure. you know, buying stuff from afar.
Yeah.
And Hamadads as well, if you're vegan, because they've got like locally grown lentils and locally grown, you know, fava beans and things like that. So you can totally support a vegan diet through regenerative or at least organic farming, if you have the privilege of money, of course, because this doesn't come cheap. But, you know, Riverford, like, I compared my food bill to my dad's food bill. My dad buys from like Iceland and like, you know, places like that, and it's about 5 pounds more expensive, and we both have 2 people in our household.
Mm-hmm. And this is just based in the UK, right?
This is just based in the UK, yeah.
Okay.
If you have listeners from further afield, especially in the country now known as the USA, they've got the regenerative organic certification that just came out. So that's one way to kind of look for it, or just shop at your local farmers market, and you can look at Kiss the Ground. There's a resource online called Eat for Climate. It's a PDF and it's maybe like 3 pages, and it gives you some questions you can ask.
Oh, yeah, that's great PDF. Yeah. I always refer to it.
Yeah, it's definitely good. And same with beauty products and clothing and things like that. Like, obviously every ingredient in our medicine and our food and our beauty products, our fashion, like you name it, it's coming from the soil in some way, shape or form. And if it's not coming from the soil, it's coming from fossil fuels through the use of synthetic ingredients or plastic products. So you want to try to find the most natural source that you can. And hopefully those ingredients are coming from responsibly farmed, if not regeneratively farmed, ingredients.
Yeah. So I think some people, they argue that the basis of sort of reversing climate change lies in looking back or looking towards these existing solutions and like looking towards indigenous practices and how they tend the land and the relationship that they have with the land. Whereas some other people prefer to look towards like futuristic technologies and green technologies as a way to mitigate climate change. I was just wondering where you sort of lie on this spectrum of solutions, and to what extent do you think we should depend on green technology to reverse or adapt to the climate crisis?
It's a complicated answer to a complicated question.
It's a long question, sorry.
Yeah, but I mean, I definitely agree, and I am very invested in, one of the reasons I came back to the UK was I read this book called If Women Rose Rooted by Sharon Blackie. Maybe it was like 3 years ago or something like that, that kind of like drove me to want to come back and connect more to the, you know, the Celtic and Norse and Anglo-Saxon, you know, indigenous ways that make up the majority of my ancestry. And because I grew up on Treaty One territory, and I grew up on welfare, I have a lot of, you know, I grew up in the same building as a bunch of indigenous folks and other non-white folks, and was able to really get a, you know, be welcomed into learning a lot about the indigenous ways of life especially for Cree and Ojibwe people who were the majority of the people I grew up with. And, you know, I do think that way of life, I mean, even just going to a powwow is to this day is the closest thing I've ever felt to like a spiritual experience. Like you can do drugs till the cows come home, but at the end of the day, like music and connecting to people without the help of necessarily with the help of, you know, drugs and alcohol and stuff like that is really, really powerful stuff. And it's something that we've almost completely disengaged with in our society. And even storytelling and connecting to each other and talking out our differences, like we really just don't have that skill anymore. So I think in many ways, indigenous ecological knowledge and also just indigenous ways of life there's another great book called The Archipelago of Hope, which is all about traditional ecological knowledge, and another one called Sacred Ecology. And the, you know, quote unquote, scientifically proven factors of indigenous ecological knowledge is the most enchanting stuff I've ever read. Like, it's better than any fairy tale. And so I think that on a cultural level, we really need to back it up like significantly and have relationships with the earth and honor the changes of the seasons. And you don't have to be like a pagan or a hippie to do that. You notice that the season is changing and you go, oh wow, it's fall, the leaves are falling, like acknowledging that and saying like, power to you tree, like, you know, when leaves fall in winter, the trees like extend their roots, they put all their energy into extending their roots and sharing nutrients with each other. Well, there's something to be learned from that. Like, we definitely, we would do no harm to look at nature for indications on how to treat each other, how to treat ourselves, and sort of how to act better. At the same time, we have all these really complicated systems that we've created. So the issue of fossil fuels is undoubtedly a problem. And renewable energy does hold the possibility to reverse global warming with the technology that we have now. Now, of course, the minerals that are required in order to create the machines that essentially capture that energy, whether it's wind or tidal or sun energy, they are consumed or they are created through open pit mining, at least for now. I'm sure there's ways we could, you know, recycle the masses of garbage that we've created in our landfills around the world to probably create those machines as well. But for now, it's coming from, you know, the global south where those minerals are kept. And that means that people who are indigenous to those areas, and they are mostly Black, Indigenous, and people of color, are not being included in that consideration of like what is better, and if it's not better for Black, Indigenous, and people of color, then it's probably not better for the environment, because if it doesn't include everyone, if a solution doesn't include everyone, then it's not really a solution. It may be a solution for a certain place, and that's also really important to consider, that like we have this tendency as a society to be like this kind of homogeny, like, you know, even when it comes to like European beauty standards, if you compare that to renewable energy, we have these European beauty standards that are like, your hair should be straight, you should be blonde, you need to be white, you need to be tall, skinny, pretty, you know, all this other bullshit that concentrates very clearly on the exterior. And you also need to be like constantly working and contributing to capitalism or your life is worthless. And that's what we're told from like childhood. But that's not the truth. Everyone is beautiful. Everyone's bodies are beautiful. Everyone's hair is beautiful. Everyone's skin is beautiful. And that's the actual truth of the thing. Of course, we're all attracted to different, you know, combinations of those external realities. But the reality is that everyone's born beautifully. And that when it comes to our communities and what heals our communities, that's going to be different, because the marginalized people in our communities, that story is going to be different everywhere. Sometimes it's people, I mean, in my community, there's a heroin problem. So it might be that the people that are most marginalized in this area are people who have a heroin problem, and it's not going to be based on skin color. We also have a lot of migrants here, so it might be that it's people that are coming from other countries and need to feel included. And there's a great project called the Refugee Buddy Program, where they pair newly arrived migrants with local folks to help them feel a part of the community. And that's like one small way of you know, contributing to regenerating a better community here, but that's not necessarily going to be the story elsewhere. So when it comes to, you know, renewable energy and the impact of that, we have to consider the full story. And that's something as a society that we're really, really bad at, which is why Indigenous ecological knowledge is so important and Indigenous wisdom is so important, because it really begins with the soil and it ends with the soil. Or the seas, like whatever sort of element the item is coming from, that's where the story, wherever it stems from, that's where the story starts and that's where the story finishes. And everything that happens along that way has to be considered. Otherwise, it's not a solution, it's sort of a band-aid. So I'm not educated enough on renewable energy to know for sure what the best pathway is, but I do know from doing some research that the majority of the jobs that will be created through renewable energy are gonna be up here in the north. It's not gonna be down in the south. Folks in the south are going to be mining for those minerals, and they're not going to be receiving the profits from that shift. So, you know, it's an imperfect solution to a huge problem, and I'm not sure what the better opportunity is, but I know that we have you know, with the right intentions and the right grounding, I think we can create solutions using the technology that we have. But we can only do that if we're able to connect to that old Indigenous way of thinking, where we consider all the living beings who are impacted along the way by the decisions that we're making, and decide, you know, with everyone involved, if that's a good decision to make. And we'll probably make mistakes, and that's okay, as long as we're like, okay to rectify it, which we're not good at right now.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That was a really, really nice. That, I really appreciate that answer.
Long.
No, it was great.
Being succinct has never been my gift, unfortunately.
I love the analogy you used as well. So you talked about how you're working for the Green Party right now. And with the Green Party, you talk a lot about the UK's Green New Deal. I'd be curious to know, how does this differ from the US Green New Deal, which people seem to hear about a lot? And also, what are some of the goals you're trying to achieve by implementing this policy?
So one of the really interesting things is all the Green New Deals actually stem from the UK, just like the one that AOC is pushing in the Sunrise Movement. Okay. They all come from the UK, and they were created by a group of environmentalists and economists, including Caroline Lucas, who's our Green Party MP. And this was back in 2008 when we had the last financial crash. And they created it as a solution to the financial crash that we were facing, to create a new economy that works within the systems that we dwell within, so within the planet's systems, to ensure that all the resources that we're taking are regenerated, are coming from regenerative sources, and that the sort of needle of growth, or the needle of success, isn't GDP, so gross domestic product, it's wellness of the communities that live within that system. So it's also a project that works to devolve power from central government and put the power, finances, and responsibilities back into the hands of communities, so that communities can make choices about what is the right, you know, what is the right renewable energy for their area, and is that renewable energy coming from an ethical source, and, you know, will it contribute to enough, you know, you might not want to have solar up in, you know, Scotland, but here in Hastings, we have the most sun in all of the UK, so we would want solar here. Or we might be growing different, you know, plants and foods down here in this clay soil that we have in Sussex that are going to be different from, you know, what's going on in the north and the way that land needs to be managed in the north. So it has a lot to do with, like, community sovereignty, putting the power back into communities to make decisions about what affects their lives, because having centralized government make those choices is another, like, act of homogeny. It expects that a single solution will solve, you know, all the unique and diverse problems that are affecting the lives of folks in various places around the UK. It also has a lot to do with international ways of, you know, running an economy. So really looking at, like, the right to stay. So the fact that a lot of migrants are forced to move because of the decisions that we make in the north about how we want to consume. And so the reason that global warming and climate breakdown is happening is not usually because of stuff that's happening in the global south, or that people in the global south are doing. It's because of stuff that we're doing here in the global north. And so some of our laws and policies need to revolve around creating environments where folks who are from the global south can thrive. And that we also have migrant policies where, if people don't want to live in the global south because they just want to explore life elsewhere, as many of us have done, you know, in our 20s, to go down to South and Central America, or to go to Australia, or, you know, to Asia, or wherever we want to go to explore a different culture, that's an opportunity that everyone has. Also not causing and supporting wars, because that contributes to destabilization. And that is one of the things that doesn't give people the right to stay where they live. Like, most migrants don't want to necessarily move. They're forced to move because it's either, you know, they stay and possibly die, or they move and possibly die, but they might have more of a chance of living if they come further up north. And then, instead of welcoming folks, we, you know, put them in camps like we have in Calais, or we arrest them when they arrive on our shores, as we've been doing here, and put them into detention camps. So that it it's a set of laws and policies that contribute to the regeneration of our society, the regeneration of land, the regeneration of soil, the regeneration of communities, and also the regeneration of like global impacts of the decisions that we make here on these islands. And I mean, you can read the manifesto, it's something like 60 pages, but they've set it out in a really great way. I think a guy named Matthew Brown, who now works in the Green Party or has been working in the Green Party, put it all together. But the other thing about the Green New Deal is that each, twice a year, the Green Party's members, so anyone can become a member for as little as £3 a month, they contribute, they go to a conference, and you can contribute to voting towards edits to those laws and policies. So it creates an environment where the Green New Deal itself is always changing, and that change is impacted by the people who are involved in the Green Party, which anybody can be a part of. So it's essentially how it runs is kind of like a citizens' assembly, but it's only with the members of the Green Party, and it creates this document that's ever changing and always, you know, at least trying to consider new discoveries, new technologies, new ways of thinking. And really, like, I do a lot of volunteer work for the Greens of Color, because the only way that, you know, these policies are going to be truly diverse or increase, you know, the rights and lives of people who are non-white is if more non-white folks get involved in politics. And Greens of Color are doing like some incredible work to, you know, adjust the policies within the Green Party's you know, manifesto to make sure that they are anti-racist as well as, you know, environmentally sound, and as well as you know, contributing to regeneration, so that we actually can come up with essentially a roadmap or a path towards a regenerative and equitable economy. So that's kind of what I see the Green New Deal being. And then the different versions around the world, there's versions in Canada, in the US and so on, just sort of are edited to reflect the needs of that country and the communities within it. Mm-hmm. But they all come from Caroline.
Okay. So for anyone who's listening from the UK, how can they support the work of the Green Party? And is there any way, I guess you mentioned a way, but are there any, I guess, like less, like a... Sorry?
A less intense ways?
Yeah, like less intense ways of getting involved.
Yeah, so you can become a Green Friend. And I mean, if you become a member, you don't have to participate in the conference that they hold twice a year. You can also just be a member of the Green Party. And that just means that you get to vote for who the leaders are, vote for the folks that are, you know, in these, what's called GPACs. So this sort of like cloud of almost like a board of directors, if you will, who get elected every couple years, I think it is. And shape politics from that realm. You don't necessarily have to be involved in conference. So from £3 a month, you can become a member. You could also become a Green Friend. So you might be a member of another party, but what the Green Party has is this sort of like supporters section where folks who are parts of other parties will, and appreciate some of the work that the Green Party does, will, you know, donate now and again, or donate monthly towards the research projects and work of the Green Party as a whole. So that's something that we're really pushing right now, because it's something that no other party does. You could become a member and stand to be a counselor. Like, we need a lot of young people, and especially non-white people, to stand in their communities to represent their neighborhoods and become town counselors. There's going to be elections this spring, so that would be very cool. And I guess just, you know, we have this page that we set up. We have these every Wednesday at 6, we have live events, and we discuss, invite folks from the green realm, whether it's, and it'll be like a hugely diverse set of people in terms of backgrounds and skin color and, you know, sex, gender, whatever it is, to talk about projects that they're doing that are living examples of the Green New Deal in action. So I mean, we get a lot of kickback because there are certain people who, you know, have this idea of politics as this really exclusive thing that, like, only folks who have, you know, graduated from some political science degree should have access to. But we've had, you know, people who, there's a woman who created, you know, a pesticide-free perfume, and she talks about how she was able to engage, you know, she was concerned about some of the rules around the beauty industry about using petrochemicals and synthetic ingredients in perfume and in beauty products. And so she, through her brand, is exemplifying what a brand would look like if the Green New Deal was in action. So what, you know, what this small portion of the economy could look like if it considered the story from soil to soil. But also she's been working with one of our green peers in the House of Lords to bring up the issue of synthetic ingredients in the beauty industry in the, you know, in the halls of power, to change what the rules are in terms of the laws and policies that control the beauty industry and the transparency of the beauty industry. So it's a really, even though she doesn't have a political science degree and hasn't been, you know, isn't your classic political activist, she is more of a political activist than most of the people who sort of take to the streets. And it's not to say that folks that take to the streets are not important, it's just that you really do create a lot of change when you focus in on what it is that you are doing in your life, your community, your skills, your industry, whatever it is, and you find ways to adjust it to reflect what it could be, or what you want to create, what you want to see in your society. So it's, there's a lot of information online. You can look at, I think it's livingroom.greenparty.co.uk, and search any subject. We've done, I don't know, something like 25 or 30 different conversations. They're all about an hour long, and there's a little blog post, you know, about what it's about and what each person does in their job, and you might find something that connects to you and what you do, and give you a little spark of how you can, what you can do to contribute to changing the world. Or that's the hope anyway.
Yeah. So a question I actually ask all the guests on my podcast is, what does being an activist mean to you? And I suppose for this interview, I'm going to add, what does being a regenerative activist mean to you?
So I've been exploring this topic a little bit because I think there's a difference between an activist and an advocate. So I consider myself an earth activist in that I try to call attention to some of the issues that we're doing to the earth. But then I'm a soil advocate. So with my soil advocacy, I try to use the knowledge that I have to push laws and policies, or adjust laws and policies to include the needs of soil, whatever they might be. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference, I guess, between like talking and acting, or like, yeah, I haven't quite figured out like how to best express it, but essentially like there's a difference between talking and doing. And activists sounds like doing, but it's actually talking. And advocates are doing, even though it sounds more like talking, I guess. It's almost like in reverse. But I think it's really important to be an activist for the rights of human and non-human beings, and be an advocate for some aspect that improves the lives of those people. So I guess that would be sort of my form of activism. My form of activism is to be an advocate, and my form of advocacy is to be an activist for the rights of human and non-human beings. Specifically,
okay.
The soil.
That's an interesting, never heard of that response before. That's an interesting way to frame it.
It's not completely a formed opinion either. It's just something that I've been thinking about since Black Lives Matter and stuff like that. And there's a really great article that I shared in my stories by, I can't remember who wrote it, but it's essentially about how green parties can be more inclusive. And Aziz Monet, who's the woman who runs the committee of the Greens of Color, had this really great quote that essentially kind of summed that up about, you know, activism is calling attention to it, but what matters is the advocacy for non-white people, for Black people, for Indigenous people, for people of color in your everyday life. So advocacy is something sort of sustained, whereas activism is almost like a quick punch. It's just like sort of shouting something. But then what you do after that is what really matters. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I'll eventually write something when I feel like I can string a sentence together about it.
Yeah, yeah, I look forward to it. So before we started this interview, you're talking about how your work from the Green Party is sort of spilling over into your weekend. And obviously you're you must be like a really busy person. So I'm just wondering, how do you remain grounded and how do you sort of balance between doing this advocacy work and also trying not to, I guess,
burn out
by this whole like capitalist system too much, if that makes sense? Disconnect occasionally.
I wish I was far enough on my journey to have a really good answer to that. I constantly burn myself out. It's a big problem in my life that I have to that I'm trying to find solutions to. And the NAP Ministry is really great. This Instagram page that talks a lot about like capitalism mm-hmm. and what tells you you're not okay to rest. So some of the things that I've implemented so far, and they're for sure not enough things, but I mean, every single morning I get up, I do like a good body stretch, and then I go for a run and a swim in the sea. I'm really so happy to no longer be living in a big city and to have access to a waterway that is not too polluted to jump into on most days. I spend time in my garden. Like at lunchtime, I'll go and sit and eat lunch in the garden if it's not raining, and try to like tend to some of my plants, although I'm definitely a fair weather gardener most days. So yeah, I do that. I read a lot, and I recently got this journal from, it's called Plan Her. And it's a woman that follows my work, and it's a really beautiful journal. And so I've been trying to also journal every day so that I don't get sort of all my ideas pent up and let my less attractive personality traits take over. And I mean, community is really important to me. Like, you know, I know that Instagram is probably not the most healthy place, but for many people who are delving into the realm of activism or advocacy, it can be a really lonely road because it's the road less traveled for the time being. And so it's really hard to sometimes maintain some of the relationship that you have because you're on this lonely road, especially with advocacy, because it's so hyper-focused. Like nobody wants to talk to me about soil health in real life. So having, you know, people that you can talk to or that are interested in talking to you about the things that you're interested in and finding ways to communicate about them that are less intense than just like you were saying before, just like spitting a bunch of scientific facts at people. I think that helps me stay grounded, even though most of my soil community is online and not offline. Technically it could be seen as unhealthy, but I think for me personally, it's okay.
Yeah.
Most days.
Yeah, I definitely agree that it's so powerful to have like a community online, even if it's through social media.
Yeah.
Of like people who are interested in the same things and being able to share that with each other.
I think so. And it, you know, it translates offline too. Like there's quite a few people who I was introduced to via my Instagram page, people who read my work, yourself included, who I actually have a genuine, you know, connection with and am happy to have conversations with, even though we don't know each other, you know, in person. We do have an understanding of who each other are. And I think there's that kind of weird thing when you're a like quote unquote influencer, which I don't really consider myself to be, but like I understand that I have a certain level of influence from the number of people who've chosen to press follow on the page that I own. Mm-hmm. But I think it creates this image of hierarchy of like me speaking at people, which is what I'm doing right now. But at the same time, you and I have DM conversations behind the scenes about the things that we're interested in, but the things that we're talking about. And I don't know if everyone does that. I assume they do. Like we, people who have pages like mine, we tend to talk to each other and have relationships outside of the Instagram world. But I think it's so important to talk to people and find those friendships within, you know, within the subgroup that you're focused in on.
Yeah, for sure. And it's definitely so interesting to learn from people who are from different places as well. And I think social media really just allows that, like enables those conversations.
Oh, and there's so many, especially as, you know, I'm a cisgender white woman, like I'm certainly not, I don't always think of things from the right perspective and I miss things. And you know, having people in my realm or my echo chamber or whatever, who feel safe to reach out to me and say like, oh, did you consider this? And I make mistakes all the time. And if I do, I usually own up to them and we'll follow up with a story or something. But I really appreciate having those safe spaces to have these uncomfortable conversations or to learn from my mistakes and to share my mistakes with other people. Like, I think there's a real issue in our society of expecting perfection from everyone, but that really holds us back from taking, you know, from jumping into the void and trying to find solutions because we're so scared of making mistakes. You know, it's a balance again of doing, you know, our anti-racism work and understanding the systems that make up our reality, but also being brave enough to take a step forward and maybe be yelled at by the entire internet at some point, but like knowing that you're doing it for the right reasons and that you're okay with doing the wrong thing if that's the way you're going to learn, or if that's what's on your journey of growth.
Yeah, for sure. And so I guess finally, what are your main sources of inspiration? I know you've mentioned quite a few resources and like other recommendations throughout this conversation, but I guess just as a final word and also to leave people on a hopeful note, what are some resources or general advice you would recommend to someone who wants to get more involved with fighting the climate crisis?
I mean, for me, the soil advocacy course with Kiss the Ground that both you and I did, that was huge. That was a huge source of inspiration. And it's one of those like kind of wells that keep on your chapter, you know, books that keep on having new chapters that or keep flowering in different ways. That was a huge one. I'm also part of the Anti-Racism Book Club. So I think we're on like month 4. And that's been a really good way to sort of stay focused. As much as I'm focused on soil, I've been doing the anti-racism work for maybe 3 years, but I've never been having this book club to meet with every month and a book to read every month helps me stay committed to that in a really like present way. And I've noticed a huge change in terms of my learning curve, where before it was something that I did like, you know, I would each season kind of check in again and do me my white supremacy journaling and stuff like that. But it wasn't as impactful as like having these really uncomfortable conversations in the safe space that's created by the Anti-Racism Book Club, which you can find on Instagram. There's a lot of people online that I really appreciate. Kamea Chain, who does Green Dreamer. Kamea Shane, sorry, she's a good friend of mine. Renee Elizabeth Peters, another one of my soil sisters. Kiss the Ground, Zach Bush, The Mirror, who's a pal, Celine Seaman. I'm trying to think of some of my other favorites. Yeah, I mean, those are some of my top. Whitney Buick, I love her work. Like there's certain people that I'll stop and read every single thing that they produce because I really appreciate their perspective. And so many books like Braiding Sweetgrass, If Women Rose Rooted, Wilding. There's How to Be an Anti-Racist was a really powerful book that I reread recently. And documentaries like Kiss the Ground has a documentary coming out on the 22nd of September on regenerative agriculture. I recently watched one called The Work, which was incredible. Another one that's called Octopus or something like that. And, you know, that's a really nice passive way to learn. Sometimes it's a bit intense, but you just never know when you're going to find that, like, that thing that's going to be your thing that you contribute to, like, the web of change, like, your thread. So, yeah. And the Fiber Shed Movement. I really love the Fiber Shed Movement as well.
Oh, yeah. Do you know where the Kiss the Ground documentary is going to be released?
Yeah, it's released on Netflix. And actually, we're hosting a screening on the 23rd for the Green Party. And Finney and Make Peace is going to be coming to answer some questions, along with Natalie Bennett, who's our Green peer in the House of Lords, who's happens to be a soil advocate as well. And two farmers, smallholder agricultural farmers from the Land Workers Association, Joyeti Fernandez, who's a farmer in Devon, and Sam Robinson, who's a shepherd in Wales. So it should be, I'm really excited for that conversation because I can just geek out on soil stuff and learn about like what that is in England compared to what I've learned from Kiss the Ground.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be really interesting. Okay, I'll look more into that. Thank you for the information.
Yeah, of course. And the Green Party has agroecology as part of their policies. So that's one of the reasons why I joined them. I was like, all right, you're going to regenerate soil, I will.
Is that your focus? Are you in that department?
No, I mean, the Green Party is so tiny. Like, the actual staff team is tiny. It's a very underfunded party. Like, the Green Party has, like, I don't know, it's something like 200% less, you know, income through donations than all the other parties in the UK. So they need people to get involved and become members or supporters. And just like, yeah, the way that you contribute to the policies is through those conferences, which are really interesting. Especially when we're allowed to meet in person, because there's so many, like, so many different characters.
Yeah,
for interactive, sure. Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to rate and review the show, because that makes a huge difference in helping me get the word of the podcast out.
Also, if you have learned anything from this podcast and want to support the show financially, I would be really grateful if you could leave a one-time or monthly coffee donation through the link in the show notes to support the continuation of this show.
Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.